this week's parasha, Parasha Shlach, talks about, at least the beginning of the parasha, talks about the Meraglim, the spies that Moshe Avinu sent into Eretz Yisrael to check it out. Moshe gave them instructions to find out various details about the land, about the people of the land, to prepare for going and invading and taking over Eretz Yisrael. The Haftarah, corresponding to that, comes from Sefer Yehoshua, the second perek of Sefer Yehoshua, which talks about a very similar incident. By the second attempt of the Jewish people to go into Eretz Yisrael, after they were turned back, after the sin of the Meraglim, so now finally, after 40 years, they were ready to go into Eretz Yisrael, and this perek discusses how Yehoshua, as we'll see, sent Meraglim as well, spies into Eretz Yisrael, once again, to check it out, before they, Jewish people, together, would all go into Eretz Yisrael. So our Torah begins like this. Perek Beis, Pasuk Aleph. Vayishlach Yehoshua ben Nun min Hashitim. Yehoshua ben Nun, who was now the leader of the Jewish people after the passing of Moshe Rabbeinu, sent from Shittim, that's where the Jewish people were camping out. He sent Shnayim Anoshim Miraglim Cheresh Lamer. So he sent two men as spies, as it says Cheresh, we'll get back to the word Cheresh soon. Lamer say, he said to them, L'chu ru'u es ha'oretz v'esirichoy, go see the land, the entire land, v'esirichoy, specifically Yerichoy. That would be the first point of attack, where the Jewish people would attack there and enter into Eretz Yisrael. Vayelchu vayavoyu beis isho zoyno u'shemoh rochov, vayishkivu shamo. So vayelchu, they went, vayavoyu, and they came, beis isho zoyno, to the house of a woman who was a zoyno. I'll get back to that shortly. U'shemoh rochov, her name was Rochov. Vayishkivu shamo, and they lay down to go to sleep there. You know, they went to stay there. So Yehoshua ben Nun, in advance of the Jewish people attacking Yericho and entering into Eretz Yisrael, he sends two men as spies to go spy out the land, and specifically the city of Yericho. And who are these two people? The Medrash says, the Medrash Tanhuma tells us, it's somewhere in here, it's if you look on source Ches, it's page number 3, it should be the front page of your second, front side of your second page. So, source Ches, the bottom line says, Umihoyu, it's the second to last paragraph on the page, Umihoyu, the last line, Shonu Rabbi Yisainu Elu Pinchas the Kolev. Who are these two spies, these two messengers of Pinchas and Kolev? They're the ones who Yehoshua ben Nun sent to spy the land of Eretz Yisrael, and specifically Yericho. And the question that immediately comes to mind when we read these psukim is, how could Yehoshua do this? So Yehoshua himself saw firsthand what happened when Moshe Rabbeinu sent the spies into Eretz Yisrael. Things did not work out very well. So first of all, why did Yehoshua need to send spies? You know, Hashem promised Yehoshua he's going to bring them into Eretz Yisrael. Hashem had promised them before Moshe Rabbeinu sent spies that they'd go into Eretz Yisrael. And now they were 40 years in the Midbar. Hashem told them he's going to bring them into Eretz Yisrael. So they'll go, they'll attack, they'll be successful. Why did Yehoshua need to send spies? Hashem promised them everything would be fine. And second of all, how could he do that? How could it seem to be negligent? It worked out at the end, but it would seem to be a bad idea. Yehoshua ben Nun was one of the Meraglim himself the first time around, and he saw firsthand how things did not work out very well. So how did Yehoshua feel confident to do the same thing that Moshe Rabbeinu, his Rebbe, had done 40 years before? How could he feel confident to do that again? Why was he not worried about the possible outcome that it might resemble that which happened 40 years earlier in the time of Moshe Rabbeinu? So first things first. Why did Yehoshua want to send spies? Hashem promised them. Hashem told them, you know, in Eretz Yisrael. What did he need that for? So Ramban, in the beginning of this week's parasha, beginning of parasha Shlach, the Ramban speaks at great length about the whole issue of the Meraglim and what they did, what they should have done, what they shouldn't have done. And one thing that Ramban writes is that the truth is, it was absolutely appropriate and proper to send Meraglim, send spies into Eretz Yisrael. The sin was not the act itself of sending in spies, of sending people in to check out the land to see the best way to conquer it. There was nothing wrong with that whatsoever. That the Ramban writes is the normal way of warfare, is that before you go in and you attack somewhere, so you send people on a mission to to go find out, to spy out, find out where are the strong points, where are the weak points, what's the best method of attack, all sorts of different considerations that there are when you fight a war and you attack. So we need to find all these things out in order to fight a war. So therefore it's absolutely legitimate for Moshe Rabbeinu to send the Meraglim, for Yeshua to send the Meraglim. He says we find these other instances as well. We find the Sefer Devarim. It talks about Veishlach Moshe L'Ragel as Yazer. They were attacking when they were getting to the Eber HaYarden, when they were conquering land in the Transjordan, the other side of the Yarden. So there Moshe Rabbeinu as well, when they went to fight a war, Moshe did the same thing again. So we see, we're not going to say that Moshe Rabbeinu didn't learn his lesson from when he sent the 12 spies. So obviously Moshe Rabbeinu understood that sending spies is not a problem. That's not the issue. It's not the issue at all. And he says, what's the reason for that? Why? So at the end of the day, Hashem promised. So the Ramban writes a very important idea. If you look in the bold words, bold italicized words, over here in the Ramban, on the first page, it says, so he quotes the pasuk in Haftarah, Yeshua ben Nun, he also sent in the spies. Besides, since it's the proper thing to do, we find even Yeshua did it. That's why it was Moshe Rabbeinu was fine with sending the spies. The pasuk of the Torah, Hashem does not want us to rely in all our actions on miracles. Rather, the Torah commands us when we fight a war, we should take up arms, we should guard ourselves, we should ambush, we should strategize. Shouldn't just walk into war without any preparation, without the proper weapons, without the proper training. In fact, when the Torah wants us to fight a war, it wants us to go about all the normal methods of preparing for and fighting a war, we're expected to do as well. Because the Torah does not desire for us to rely on miracles. It's a fundamental idea that applies not only here but elsewhere as well. We're not supposed to rely on miracles, even if we think that it's very possible a miracle could happen. But still, we shouldn't rely on miracles. We should try to go about things in the most natural way. Even more so, as we'll see, even in a situation where a miracle is necessary, it's inevitable. There's going to have to be a miracle to make things work out. Still, a person is supposed to try to incorporate as much as they can teva, the natural manners, the natural ways, into that situation, even if inevitably a miracle will have to happen as well. And that's why sending spies here was, even in a situation where Hashem promised that they'd come into Eretz Yisrael, that they'd defeat their enemies, they wouldn't have any problems at all, still the proper thing to do was to send the Raglim to go about the normal procedures, the normal preparation for fighting the war, send in spies to check out the land. That was a normal thing to do, and that was actually what's expected and the proper thing to do, because we don't rely on miracles. Fighting a war and capturing the land without sending in spies ahead of time would be a miracle. It would be miraculous. That's not the normal way to fight a war and be successful. And so therefore, since it's the normal thing to do, therefore Moshe Rabbeinu and Yeshua were both expected to send in spies. Now why is this that we should not rely on miracles? Hashem said He's going to help them defeat their enemies, so why not? Hashem made the promise, so why do we have to do anything more than that? Why should we not rely on miracles? And if you look in source number 4, source Dalet, the Drush HaYisharan, in the Drush HaShmini, the 8th Drush, the Ran there talks about the sin of Moshe of Nei Meriva, when Moshe hit the rock. And in the middle of the discussion, he sets up over here a number of hakdamas before he introduces his approach, his understanding of Moshe Rabbeinu's sin with Mei Meriva, with hitting the rock. He gives a few introductions. So the first introduction, he says that Hashem desires to maintain the normal, the natural course of events in the world as much as He can. He says, the natural way of the world is beloved to Hashem, it's precious to Hashem, and Hashem won't change it unless He absolutely has to. If you think about it, we consider nature, the natural course of events in the world, to just be the regular default of the way the world runs on autopilot. So to us, we often think that, okay, so what's the big deal? If Hashem wants to do a nes and He'll change it, what's the big deal? Hasn't Hashem Hashem has the power to change nature. Hashem has the power to make nisim, to make miracles. It doesn't cost Hashem anything. So what's the big deal? If Hashem wants to make it nice, let him make it nice. What does it bother Hashem? But the truth is, if we think about it, that even the teva, even the nature, is really Hashem's way of running the world. It's a more consistent way that Hashem runs the world, as opposed to miracles, which are against the normal expected way of that the world works. But the nature is Hashem constantly doing miracles on a constant basis, a moment-to-moment basis, that Hashem runs the world in a certain way. Those are the way that Hashem hands-on is running the world. And it must be that's the way Hashem desires for the world to run. It's not as if Hashem just set the world on autopilot for it to run in a certain way. There's gravity, the grass grows from the ground, the sun rises in the morning and sets at night. All those things aren't just the world running on autopilot, on the default, without any involvement. That's the way Hashem desires on a second-to-second basis that the world should run, that the world should exist. So therefore, when Hashem does a nes, when Hashem does a miracle, Hashem changes that, that means Hashem's changing the way He ideally desires the world to work. The reason why the world runs the way it runs is not just because, it's not just by default. It's not just randomly that this happens to be the way the world works. The way the world runs, what we call nature, what's natural to us, is Hashem's desire for the world to run like this. This is the best, this is the way that Hashem feels that is the Kiddushim Shemayim is brought out best in the world, right? The world exists. That whatever Hashem created in the world, Hashem created it to bring out His glory. So therefore, the way in which the world runs is the way that Hashem feels that His glory, His Kiddushim Shemayim is best brought out in the world. And therefore, says the Ran, Hashem doesn't desire to change that. And Hashem will only change it if it's absolutely necessary. It says, therefore, we shouldn't rely on miracles. Because relying on miracles means we're forcing Hashem to change the natural course of events, the natural way that the world works, which is something that Hashem doesn't desire to do, something that Hashem is very apprehensive and hesitant about. Hashem doesn't want to do that. So therefore, that's why we shouldn't rely on miracles. Miracles means Hashem changing things from the way He ideally would like them to be, and therefore we have no right to, sort of, so to speak, push Hashem into a corner like that. Here Hashem told Moshe, Hashem told Yahushua, I'm going to bring the Jewish people into Eretz Yisrael. So now if they just sit back and say, okay, fine, Hashem, let us know when to go, we'll start marching and You take care of the rest, that would force Hashem, because Hashem is going to keep His word, that would force Hashem to change the nature of the world, to change the way things normally work. For an army to just go and attack without any preparation, without any training, without sending spies ahead of time to find out what exactly it is that they're attacking, where to attack properly, there's naturally it shouldn't work. That would force Hashem to change from the natural running of the world, which is something that Hashem doesn't desire to do. Therefore, it was important that they said that send the menagim, they send these spies ahead to go check out Eretz Yisrael, to do things in the most natural way. Now, even if we have to argue that despite that, even with sending in spies, still, the army of the Jewish people wasn't so powerful. Perhaps they weren't as numerous as the numerous kingdoms and armies that were in Eretz Yisrael. So they'd still have to come on to a miracle to be successful, to defeat all those enemies, to conquer Eretz Yisrael. The Ran says that no, like we mentioned before, even in a situation where a miracle is necessary, even when there's no way to avoid a miracle, but Hashem wants to minimize the miracles as much as possible. If you have an untrained army going up against 20 armies, which are 20 times their size, so that's a much greater miracle than if you have a well-trained army, a well-prepared army, going up against the same enemy. That's much greater than it. It's less of a miracle. It's more natural. There we can say, okay, they're better prepared. They prepared better. They're better trained. They're stronger. They have better strategy. It's more fits into the nature of the world. The more that we do things in the natural way, the more that we go about the normal course of events. He says an example of this is we find by Noach. Noach built a table. Right. Noach built a table to save himself and his family and the animals from the mabul, from the flood. And the truth is that really although Noach's table was pretty big, but to fit in all of the animals, to two of the non-kosher ones and seven of the kosher ones, the males and females and all the birds and all sorts of different creatures and his family and food, there was no way that even a teva of that size would be able to fit all those things. So inevitably, he had to come on to a miracle for Hashem to allow all those things to fit into the teva. So why did Hashem tell him to make such a big teva? Why didn't he just make a regular sized teva? It took him 120 years to build the teva. Why didn't you tell him build a little boat? Anyway, Hashem's going to have to perform miracles. Just build a little boat, and you'll go into that, and Hashem will make the miracle, and everything will work out. Why did he tell him to make such a big, huge boat? So the answer is that even though they would have to come onto a miracle, inevitably they're going to have to defy nature and fit so many people and so many animals and creatures into this teva, which is not really big enough, but to make it somewhat more natural, Hashem told Noach to make it bigger. Make it big, make it very big. Okay, you're right. It's still not going to work. Still not going to work based on the normal laws of nature. But let's make it very big. At least it's a little closer. It seems a little more likely that it should work. And this way you can minimize in how much you're deviating from the normal course of the world. Because again, Hashem, the way that Hashem runs the world on a regular basis is the way Hashem wants the world to be run. And deviating from that is something that Hashem tries to avoid. And therefore we should have tried to avoid it as well. In the Sefer Som Derech from Sivchos Zisil Broido, he suggests perhaps another explanation why we shouldn't rely on miracles, why the Torah wants us to specifically try to go about things in the most natural way and not rely on a miracle. He quotes the famous words of the Ramban at the end of Parshas Bo. The Ramban writes in discussing the mitzvahs, the commandments that Hashem gave us to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, to remember the exodus from Egypt. Ramban explains that the reason why these are so important, there's so many different mitzvahs that are to commemorate Yetzias Mitzrayim, is because when Hanisim HaGadolim HaMefor Samim, from the great, widespread, publicized miracles, a person comes to realize, comes to notice, even the smaller miracles. When we think about Yetzias Mitzrayim was the greatest display of Hashem's miracles, of Hashem's might, in history. And that clearly brought out Hashem's presence in the world. It clearly brought out that Hashem runs the world. When we recognize that, when we remember that on a constant basis, that allows us to notice even the smaller miracles. The smaller miracles in our lives, to realize that everything that happens in our lives is all miracles, it's all Hashem running the world. If it's more consistent and get used to it, despite that, still, it's Hashem is the one who's running the world on a regular basis, and it's all the great miracles and the small miracles, nature, it's all the same, it's all Hashem running the world. And that's why it's very important to constantly remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, to remember, yes, from there it was very clear that Hashem's running the world. That will help me realize, it'll help me remember in my daily life, everything that I encounter, it's all Hashem running the world. See, he says that if a person relies on a miracle, then that gets a person to think that miracles come from Hashem, but otherwise I'm doing it on my own. If I'm relying on the miracle, it means I'm saying, well, here, I have two choices in front of me. Either I'll put in some effort, or I'll rely on a miracle. So that means that if I'm relying on a miracle, how's it going to happen? Well, if I rely on a miracle, it means Hashem's taking care of it. That leads me to believe then, that when I don't rely on the miracle, that must be me doing it. So if a person avoids relying on the miracle, a person realizes that despite the fact that it might be difficult for him to do this on his own, he doesn't want to do it on his own, but he realizes when he goes through the motions himself, when he goes through it in the so-called natural way, that helps a person to realize that everything comes from Hashem. Relying on a miracle makes a person think that Hashem does miracles. When a person does it on his own, that helps a person. It's an exercise in a person's emunah, in Hashem, in a person's belief that Hashem is the one who's running the world. It causes the person to realize that even when he goes through the motions, when he puts in the effort and goes about it in this so-called normal, natural manner, it's still Hashem is the one who's running the world. If we just rely on miracles, then we don't get the opportunity to think about it, to contemplate the fact that even when I am involved on my own, Hashem's still the one who's doing it. But when I put in the effort myself, when I go through the motions, when I do it in the natural way, that helps the person realize that even in a regular circumstance, even in the natural way, is really miracles of Hashem. Hashem is the one who's running the world. So that answers the question of why Yehoshua wanted to send Meraglim, why he wanted to send spies, why wasn't he confident that Hashem would help them conquer Eretz Yisrael and defeat their enemies even without sending in spies? Because he wanted to follow the natural course, the natural procedures, because that's what Hashem desires for a person to do. So no matter how was Yeshua confident that he would avoid the problems that his Rebbe Moshe Rabbeinu ran into when he sent Meraglim, the spies, into Eretz Yisrael. So here's where we come back to the word Cheresh. Take a look back in the Pasuk. The Pasuk said that Yeshua sent Shnei Anoshim Meraglim Cheresh. He sent two men who were spies, Cheresh. So what does the word Cheresh mean? There are a number of different explanations of the word Cheresh. The Targum Yonasan ben Uziel on the Pasuk, says that Cheresh means Biroz. Biroz means in secret, in quietly, hidden. The Radak explains that why does the Pasuk tell us that Yeshua sent them quietly? Yeshua sent them Biroz in a way that's hidden. He says, because Yeshua didn't want the people to know, the rest of Klal Yisrael, the rest of the Jewish people to know that he was sending spies. If they would know that he's sending spies, they would make them nervous. So he'd say, we must be up against a very strong and capable enemy here. And that would make the people nervous, and that would perhaps give the potential for the same results that happened when Moshe Rabbeinu sent his spies into Eretz Yisrael. If everyone knew about it, that would get people thinking, that would get people nervous. Yeshua said, I'm not going to have any of that. I'm going to do this quietly. No one will know about it. I'll send them with no fanfare whatsoever. They'll go, they'll come back. No, this way, there won't be the opportunity for anyone to get nervous, and there won't be any opportunity for the same terrible outcome that happened when Moshe Rabbeinu sent in his miraglim. When they come back, and they give a good report, which Yeshua was confident that they would, so then Yeshua could then publicize the report that they'll come back with. They'll tell everyone how the people, the nations there are trembling, they're so fearful of the Jewish people, and that'll give the people confidence, it'll give them a boost to their morale when they realize that their enemies are trembling, are scared of them, and they'll be able to go and fight that Eretz Yisrael properly. So that's the Radak's approach, based on the Targum's understanding of the word Cheresh. That's how Yeshua avoided a possible repeat of what happened with the original Meraglim, is by doing everything quietly, in a hidden manner, in a way that people didn't know about it. The Mitzudais explains the word Cheresh differently. The Mitzudais says the word Cheresh means machshava, thoughts. The word Cheresh, he brings different examples where we find the word Cheresh could refer to thoughts. The Ralbag, which is quoted here on source Hay, the Ralbag explains based on this, he says that there is two reasons why one might send spies ahead of his army to go see what's happening in the enemy land. One reason is a very practical, strategic reason to be able to see, like we mentioned before, to be able to see where's the best place to attack, where are the weak points, who are we going up against, right? And bring it into contemporary terms, right? How many tanks do they have, where are their anti-aircraft weapons, so on and so forth, to know exactly what you're going up against, you could properly plan to fight against them. That's one reason. He says the second reason is to simply find out what's the morale of the people who you're going up against. Like, what are they thinking? Are they themselves worried? Are they confident that they're going to win? Do they feel like they have the upper hand? Are they going into this war feeling that they're likely to succeed? Or are they scared? Are they worried? Are they themselves doubtful about whether they can be successful or not? And that is for the sole purpose of being able to support the morale of your troops. If we know that they're scared of us, that they're worried, they're concerned, they're not confident they're going to defeat us, so that makes us feel more confident that we can go into the war with strong feelings that we'll be successful, we'll be much more positive about it, we'll be much more confident.
The translation of that word again, cheresh, the second translation.
So that means thoughts. It means thoughts. Cheresh means miraglim cheresh. Means that they're going to spy out their thoughts.
Thank you.
It's not right. In other words, it's not according to this explanation. It's not a description of the sending of the messengers. Rather, the purpose of the sending of the messengers. Miraglim cheresh, that they're spying out the thoughts. So he says, Yeshua, when he sent the Meraglim in, he only sent them in for the second reason. He only sent them for the second type of spying, only to find out about the thoughts, about the morale, about the attitude of their enemies, about the people that they're going to attack. That was the sole purpose. It had nothing to do with strategy. It had nothing to do with finding out about the place, about the different places that they're going to have to attack in Eretz Yisrael. It had nothing to do with that whatsoever. It only had to do with finding out, meeting the people, and hearing from the people how they felt, what their feelings were about the Jewish people who were coming to attack them. And the hope was that through this, we'd be able to strengthen, again, the morale of the Jewish people, that they'd be confident that they'd be able to defeat their enemies. And he says the proof to this is that, as we'll see, that they didn't really spy out the land. These two meraglim, these two spies that Yeshua sent, Kalev and Pinchas, they never actually checked out the land. They didn't find much out. All they found out was that the people were scared and the people were worried about the Jewish people who were going to come to attack them. That's all they found out. They were there for one night, and that's it. They were there for one night. They came that night, they left that night, that's all they were there for. There was no way they could have possibly checked out all the different places, and even in Yericho, and certainly not in Eretz Yisrael. Furthermore, which we're probably not going to get to, the pasuk all the way at the end of the Haftarah says that when the Meraglim, these two spies, Kalev and Pinchas, came back to Yeshua, they didn't tell him anything except for the fact that the people in Yericho, the people in Eretz Yisrael, are worried, they're concerned, they're nervous about us coming to Eretz Yisrael. That's all they tell him. They don't tell him anything about how the land was. They don't give him any more description of the land of Eretz Yisrael, of Yericho, except the fact that people were worried. Says the Ralbag, that was Yeshua's plan over here. Yeshua's plan was, he's sending in the people only to find out about the thoughts, the intentions of the people, not giving them the opportunity to see the different parts of the land and to start bringing back all sorts of reports. He's not going to fall into the same trap, so to speak, that Moshe Rabbeinu fell into with the Meraglim earlier on. Here he's not going to instruct them to spy out the land, only to find out about how the people felt, and that Yeshua felt confident they'll come back with a good report, the proper report, that the people there are scared, and that will only be beneficial to give the Jewish people confidence before, when they go to attack Eretz Yisrael. The Malbim says a third idea. The Malbim says, when Moshe sent in the Meraglim to Eretz Yisrael, he sent them because the Jewish people requested them. The Jewish people, right, as we find in the beginning of Parshas Devarim, the Mefarshim make this point, in the beginning of Sefer Devarim, there we have some of the details of the story in our Parsha, the story of the Meraglim in our Parsha, are filled in the beginning of Sefer Devarim. And there it says that the Jewish people came to Moshe, and they said, Nishalcha anoshim lefoneinu, let us send people ahead of us. Says the Malbim, that was a recipe for disaster. Because if the people asked for the Meraglim, then the Meraglim would have to report back to them. They're the ones who wanted the report. So the Meraglim have to report back to them. If the Meraglim have to report back to the people, so that's a very risky proposition. Then the Jewish people could believe what they want, they could interpret it how they want, and that led to a disastrous end. However, Yeshua, when he sent his Meraglim, when he sent Kalev and Pinchas, he sent them in by himself. The Jewish people didn't ask for it. Yeshua himself sent them. So now, they only have to report back to him. If they report back to him, so Yeshua can deal with it himself. If for some reason they bring back a bad report, so we'll ignore them. They bring back a good report, so then he can go and he can pass on their message to the people and give the people confidence, give the people the morale that they need in order to fight this war properly. It says that the Malbim says that the reason why Yeshua was more confident to send Meraglim, send spies to Eretz Yisrael, is because he sent them on his own. He didn't send them as messengers of the people, he sent them as messengers of himself. And once they were going on his behalf, then he didn't have to worry about their influence on the people, because they would only report back to him and not to the Jewish people. The Medrash gives us two other explanations of what the word cheresh means. So far we said one explanation of the word cheresh is that he did it quietly in secret. That was the Targum. Matsude said that it had to do with the thoughts. They were meraglim cheresh. They were spying out the thoughts of the people. The Medrash in Rus Rabba, Medrash Rabba in Rus, and it's also in the Medrash Tanchuma and Pasha Shlach. The Medrash says two other explanations. The first explanation is that Cheresh comes from the word Cheres. Cheres is pottery, earthenware vessels. So he says, Medrash Rabba quotes Nehemiah, who says that klei kederos hayu biyadam. They took with them these earthenware vessels to make themselves seem like they were pottery salesmen, nothing more than pottery salesmen. No one should suspect that they're spies from the Jewish people. They came in looking like ordinary pottery salesmen with their earthenware pottery vessels with them, and therefore this was an attempt to prevent any suspicion about their true motives. That's Miragun Cheresh sent them in as a pottery salesman. Alternatively, the Medrash says, you know, Cheresh comes from the word Cheresh, which means someone who's deaf. So the Medrash says, Shim ben Yechai, Bar Yechai, quoting the Medrash Rabba, says that he sent them in and they should act as if they're deaf. Some say they should act as if they're deaf and mute. Mitzvah will get back to that. That they should act like they're deaf. They should pretend they don't hear anything. Now, inevitably, if they're going to pretend they don't hear anything, then they have to not talk very much either, because if they talk in response to what people say, it makes it pretty obvious that they're not deaf. So they have to play deaf. That was Yeshua's plan, and his hope was that if they play deaf, people don't realize they can hear, then the people will talk around them, say things around them, thinking that they can't hear them, and that'll allow them to get some useful information from the people that they encounter, because people will not hide their secrets from them, because they'll assume that you can't hear them because they're deaf. That's the word cheresh, four different explanations of the word cheresh. Now, the pasuk says that, where did they go to? They came to the house of an isha zoyna ushemah rochav. They came to the house of a woman who was a zoyna, and her name was Rochav. So the Targum on the pasuk says that what does it mean, what does the word zoyna mean? It says pundekois, which seems to mean that she was either she sold food, or she had some sort of a hotel, some sort of a place for people to stay. That's what the Targum seems to say. However, the Gemara Maseches Zvachim, Daf Kufta Zayin, which is source Zayin here, makes it very clear that the Gemara understands that Rochav was a Zoyna in the true sense of the word. She was a harlot, a prostitute. That's what it means. The word Zoyna normally means, and the Gemara there makes it very clear. It says, Ein l'chol kol sar v'nogin shleibol Rochav ha-Zoyna. So it will be important later. Gemara says that there was no officer or important official who had not had relations with Rochav. Rochav was a Zoyna, she was a very popular Zoyna, and all of the dignitaries, all of the officers, all the important people throughout the land in Eretz Yisrael had made use of Rochav's services, that they had all lived together with Rochav. And the Gemara seems to understand that when it says she was a Zoyna, it means that the normal implication of the word. Now, the Radak suggests that even the Targum means that, even when the Targum says Puntakoyas, really the Targum means that as well. So that's the meaning of our pasuk. There's a very interesting medrash which discusses these miraglim, these two miraglim, which Chazal tell us are Kalev and Pinchas. It's a very interesting medrash. Medrash Tanchuma, which is in Source Ches, beginning of Pasha Shlach, the medrash starts discussing the following question. It talks about the idea of traveling out to sea before Shabbos. And the Medrash says that Chazal tell us that the halacha is the one's not allowed to go out on a boat into the sea in the 3 days preceding Shabbos. If he intends to go out on a long trip, if you're just going on the, what episode is it called, the lollipop boat, on a little trip, then I don't think that's included. But going on a long trip on a boat out to sea within the 3 days before Shabbos is not permitted. There's different reasons given. One reason is because in the beginning of a trip out at sea, a person a lot of times doesn't feel so well, makes a person feel sick. We don't want a person to feel sick on Shabbos. So we say start out earlier in the week. By the time Shabbos comes, you'll feel a little better. Or alternatively, sometimes at the beginning of a boat trip is, excuse the pun, not so smooth sailing. So therefore, we're afraid that perhaps the emergencies will come up in the beginning of the trip before things are completely settled, and that'll have to be Mechal Shabbos to make things be right and to make sure that everything is going properly, that they're not in sakana. So if we say leave earlier in the week, by the time Shabbos comes, you'll have everything figured out, the sales will be proper, and everything will be done, instead you'll be able to just sail smoothly on Shabbos and not have to mechal Shabbos at all. Okay, those are the reasons given. But that's what the Medrash says. Medrash says that one is not allowed to go out to sea on a boat within the 3 days before Shabbos. And the Medrash says that that only applies to someone who's going on some sort of voluntary trip. He's going on a cruise, or he's going out for business. That was probably the more normal application back in those days. He had to go out to go out to sea, go buy wares, sell his wares. That's what he was traveling out to sea. However, Medrash says if it was a shliach mitzvah, if he's on a mission to do a mitzvah, that's why he's traveling on the boat out to sea, so then he can go whenever he wants, even in 3 days before Shabbos. Why? The Medrash explains why. Preshu shliach mitzvah. The shliach mitzvah doiches haShabbos. He's a messenger to do a mitzvah, and a messenger to do a mitzvah, at least in this, as far as this law of Shabbos is concerned, that overrides this concern, this Shabbos concern of traveling 3 days before Shabbos. If he's going to do a mitzvah, then we allow him to go even within the 3 days before Shabbos. And the Medrash continues. Says, "V'chein ata moitzei b'sukkah." Says, you find the same idea, the same concept that we say, a shliach mitzvah, someone who's on a mission to go do a mitzvah, that overrides other mitzvah considerations, we find the same idea by sukkah. What do we find by sukkah? We say, shluchei mitzvah b'turim min ha-sukkah. Someone who's a messenger, someone who's on a mission to do a mitzvah, he's exempt from sukkah. Now here, the Medrash says something very interesting. The Medrash says, why is that? There's nothing more beloved in front of Hashem, kishliach mitzvah, like a messenger to do a mitzvah. Shehu mishtaleach la'aseis mitzvah. He's being sent on a mission to do a mitzvah. V'noisei nafshoi k'dei shi'atzliach b'shlichusai. And he gives up himself. He puts his life on the line, he gives up from himself, shi'atzliach b'shlichusai. He should be successful in his mission, he should be successful in doing the mitzvah. Medrash says that this idea, that the shliach mitzvah is considered to be very important. Someone who's on a mission, he's sent to do a mitzvah, that we give him special consideration, we find that by the mitzvah of sukkah as well. We say a shliach mitzvah, someone who's on a mission, to go do a mitzvah, he's exempt from sukkah. And what's the reason for that? Medrash explains, because someone who's on a mission to do a mitzvah is very beloved by Hashem, because he's sent to do a mitzvah, and he gives up from himself in order to be successful on his mission. Medrash goes on to say, what's a prime example of shluchei mitzvah? People who are sent on a mission to do a mitzvah, that they're very beloved to Hashem. Ve'en lecha b'nei odom shidishtalchu la'aseis mitzvah. You won't, there's no people who are sent to do a mitzvah, v'noisin ha'mafshom la'atzniach shlichusan, and they give them of themselves to be successful in a mission, ka'oison shnei shluchim sheshach Yahushua ben Nun. Like those two messengers, Kalev and Pinchas, who Yahushua ben Nun sent, Shenemar, it says, Vayishlach Yahushua ben Nun, that Yahushua ben Nun sent these two people. Says the Medrash that these two messengers, these two spies, Kalev and Pinchas, we find in our Haftarah, they're the prime example of messengers who are sent to do a mitzvah, that they give of themselves to be successful, and they're very beloved by Hashem. So there's a number of things in this, in the Medrash, that needs an explanation. First of all, practical question, not so practical question, but very technical question. Technical question. The Medrash talks about the exemption of a shliach mitzvah from sukkah. The Medrash says that a shluchei mitzvah, someone who's on a mission to do a mitzvah, is exempt from sukkah, and the Medrash attributes it to the fact that shluchei mitzvah, people who are sent on a mission to do a mitzvah, that they're so beloved by Hashem, and that overrides any other mitzvah considerations. And the truth is, if you learn the Gemaras in various places, in Masechet Sukkah, elsewhere, it's quite clear that the basis for the exemption of a shliach mitzvah from the mitzvah of sukkah, the reason why he's exempt, is because of a rule, a very broad rule, which is that ha'isik b'mitzvah, someone who's busy with one mitzvah, potem na mitzvah, is exempt from a different mitzvah. It's a very regular, very normal exemption that we find. The reason why he's exempt from sukkah is because he's busy with a different mitzvah. The Medrash seems to understand that there's something unique about someone who's a shliach mitzvah, as opposed to a regular person who's doing a mitzvah. There's someone who's a shliach mitzvah. A shliach mitzvah who's being sent to do a mitzvah, so that's very beloved to Hashem, and that's something, therefore the Medrash seems to attribute this exemption that a shliach mitzvah has from the mitzvah of sukkah to the fact that he's a shliach mitzvah specifically, that he's being sent on a mission. That's what's really the cause of his exemption, that why he doesn't have to do the mitzvah of sukkah. But it doesn't seem to be what we find in other sources in Chazal, that it's a regular exemption, because what person is busy with one mitzvah is exempt from a different mitzvah. Nothing to do with chaviv in the fnei Hashem, that it's so beloved to Hashem. What's that all about? And simply, what's the difference? The Medrash seems to make a very big deal about a shliach mitzvah. It talks about a shliach mitzvah, someone who's sent on a mission to do a mitzvah. How is a shliach mitzvah different than any other person who performs a mitzvah? We don't say ha'oise mitzvah, that someone who's oise mitzvah, who does a mitzvah, is beloved in front of Hashem. No, it's specifically shluchei mitzvah. People who are sent to do a mitzvah, those are the ones who are beloved in front of Hashem. What's so special and unique about a shliach mitzvah, someone that's sent to do a mitzvah? And we could also ask, why specifically is this idea come up by sukkah and not by any other mitzvah, not by any other areas? Why specifically do we focus on the mitzvah of sukkah here? So the other week we were fortunate here in the Kollel to hear by video hookup an address from Rabbi Malkiel Kotler Shlita, the Yeshiva in Lakewood Yeshiva. It just so happened to be that he spoke about this medrash. It was perfect timing, right before this Haftarah. So, well, Hashem, I was a zoiche now to hear his words and be able to share them with you. And he explained this medrash a little more derech drush. Not necessarily saying the pshat in the medrash, but derech drush. They explain the medrash in this the following way. He says we find in the derech Hashem, say the derech Hashem from the Reb Chaim, Reb Moshe Chaim Lutzato. He writes about the mitzvah of sukkah the following. He says, we know the mitzvah of sukkah is to commemorate the Anani Akovoi, those clouds of glory that surrounded the Jewish people when they traveled through the Midbar. That's the mitzvah of sukkah. We go into the sukkah is supposed to resemble and commemorate the Anani Akovoi, those clouds which surrounded the Jewish people in the Midbar. And the Ramchal explains that those clouds which surrounded the Jewish people in the Midbar were not only there for physical protection. They weren't only there to save them from the snakes and the scorpions on the ground, and from the arrows of the Mitzrayim behind them, from the heat of the sun. They weren't only there for physical protection. Rather, Derech Hashem says, Ramchal says, that the clouds were there for spiritual reasons as well. The clouds were to surround the Jewish people, to envelop them, and to put them into a whole new world, their own special world of closeness to Hashem, to take them out of the physical world, the world of taiva, of desire, of ratzayin, the world of the darkness of the physical world, to take the Jewish people and elevate them, to envelop them into a spiritual world, a world of Torah, a world of mitzvahs, a world of serving Hashem, a world of dveikus to Hashem, of closeness to Hashem. Besides the physical protection that the clouds provided for the Jewish people, It also created for them a spiritual environment. They were outside of the regular world, and they were within their own special area of the Anani HaKavod, which was a spiritual, more spiritual existence, a more spiritual world, outside, disconnected from the physical world. And that's what the Anani HaKavod represented, more than just physical protection, but a spiritual haven for the Jewish people to be in, and that through that to elevate themselves to the highest levels. And he says that those Anani HaKavod, perhaps they were apparent and visible when the Jewish people were in the Midbar, but they were not limited to the Jewish people in the Midbar. He says that the effect of that Anani HaKavod continues even till today. A person who disconnects himself from the physical world, a person who's able to give up for the world of taiva, of desire, of ritzoinos, of his needs, of pleasures, to give up all the connection to the physical world, a person can enter into that spiritual realm, although we don't visibly see that Anani HaKavod, but a person can elevate himself and he can enter into those Anani HaKavod, that spiritual world, that spiritual environment, a haven in which a person can attach himself and surround himself with Torah, with mitzvahs, with avodas Hashem, with dveikas Hashem, closeness and cleaving to Hashem, to that special area, that special place of ruchnius, of spirituality, of the anani akovet. A person, even today, a person can do that. We may not see it, it might not be apparent to us, it might not be tangible. But a person who disconnects himself from the physical world enters into that spiritual world of anani akovet, where he's surrounded by ruchnius, where he's in a whole different environment, a whole different world than everyone else. Ramchal says that that's what's renewed every Sukkot. On Sukkot, when we commemorate the Anani HaKavod, we leave our Divas Kva, we leave the comfort, the luxury, the pleasure of our normal home, of our permanent home, and we go into the Sukkah, which represents the Anani HaKavod. We disconnect ourselves from the physical, materialistic world, and we enter into that those Anani HaKavod, which is represented by the Sukkah, that spiritual world. And Sukkah is a spirit, place of ruchnius, a place of spirituality, a place of Torah and mitzvahs, okay? When we eat there, but it's an elevated sort of eating. A person does his needs there, but in an elevated manner. It's a world of Anani HaKavod, a world of ruchnius, a place of Dveikos Vashem. Everything there is on an elevated spiritual level. That's what a person does on Sukkot, and that's the opportunity to renew this idea, this Anani HaKavod that we have in our world, to renew them, to come back, and to experience that transition from the physical world, which is represented by our normal living places, our permanent living places. We leave them, we disconnect ourselves from there, and go into the Sukkah, go into that Anani HaKavod, that new spiritual haven, that spiritual escape, which we envelop ourselves in Ruchnius and Avodas Hashem. That's the idea of Sukkah. See, he says, when a person's a shliach mitzvah, when a person's a messenger to do a mitzvah, that's more than just doing a mitzvah. A person who does a mitzvah, we do a lot of mitzvahs, and often it doesn't take too much from us to do a mitzvah. Someone comes around collecting tzedakah, pull out the checkbook, you write them a check, and you move on, you did your mitzvah, and you continue. A shliach mitzvah is unique in the fact that in order to do his mitzvah, he gives up from himself. He gives up the comfort of his home. Perhaps he gives up his family. He gives up the luxuries of being able to be in one place. He's on a mission. He has to go and do a mitzvah elsewhere. He gives everything up. He disconnects himself from all those, from all the pleasures, from all the desires that he's used to. He leaves them behind and he goes, he embarks on a shlichus, on a mission to go and fulfill the will of Hashem. That, says the Medrash, is something that's very beloved to Hashem. That, the Medrash says, is Ein lecha chovav v'nei HaKadosh Baruch Hu kishliach mitzvah. There's nothing so beloved to Hashem like a shliach mitzvah, someone who's on a mission to do a mitzvah, not just someone who does a mitzvah. A person could do a mitzvah and have everything that he wants, everything that he desires at the same time. A shliach mitzvah, someone who's on a mission, he goes, he's going to do a mitzvah. That person is extremely beloved to Hashem. Why? Shu mishtaleach la'aseis mitzvah v'noisei nafshoi k'tishi yatzliach b'shlichusoi. He's on a mission, he's sent to do a mitzvah. V'noisei nafshoi, he gives up from himself. He gives up from his enjoyment, he gives up from his pleasure, he gives up from his desires, he gives up from his comforts, in order to be able to do the will of Hashem. That's something that's extremely beloved to Hashem. He gives up his noisei nafshoi, gives up all of his, he gives up all of his physical enjoyment, all the physical things, to cleave to Hashem, to do the will of Hashem. That is something that's extremely beloved by Hashem. And says the Malkiel, that perhaps that's the idea of the Medrash. Medrash says, specifically, the Medrash points out the mitzvah of Sukkah. Because the mitzvah of Sukkah is this idea, represents this idea that a person disconnects himself from the physical, from the taivos, from the desires, from the comforts, from the pleasures of the world. And he goes into the Sukkah, he goes and he connects himself to the world of Ruchnius, the Anani HaKavod, to spirituality. That's the mitzvah of Sukkah represents. And says the Medrash, that a person who's a shliach mitzvah, he doesn't need that. He doesn't need to reach that through the sukkah. A person who's a shliach mitzvah has accomplished the same thing even without a sukkah. A person who's a shliach mitzvah, who's on the mission to do a mitzvah, and has given up the comforts of his regular life, he's given up those pleasures to do the will of Hashem, to fulfill his mitzvah, he's exempt from sukkah. He's already accomplished the same thing without the sukkah. He's already left behind all of the gashmias, the world of desires, the world of physical and materialistic pleasures. He's already given that up to envelop himself, to connect himself to Hashem, to the ruchnias, the spirituality by doing the will of Hashem. So therefore, he's exempt from sukkah. He doesn't need the mitzvah of sukkah. He's already accomplished the same thing without it. And that's Medrash says, a prime example of that is Kalev and Pinchas. Kalev and Pinchas, they left the rest of the Jewish people behind. They went down in their own, just two people. They went into enemy territory. They went there, and you see later in the Haftarah that they gave up. They not only did they give up the comfort of home, they didn't. Not only did they give up the being surrounded by family, not only did they risk their lives, but even gave up on their pride, that to be hidden in the flax, that to be sent up to the roof and hidden to be able to protect themselves. They gave up a lot. They gave up a lot from their pleasure, from their enjoyment of this world, in order to fulfill the will of Hashem. And that's a prime example, says the Medrash, of this idea that a shliach mitzvah, someone sent to do a mitzvah, is beloved by Hashem because of his willingness to give up from his comfort, from his pleasures, to be able to devote himself to his mission, to be able to devote himself to doing the will of Hashem. And the truth is that every single person who comes onto this world is sent to the world with a mission from Hashem. Every person is sent. Hashem has desires from each person. Whatever, each person is unique. Each person has a unique mission. But a person is sent here by Hashem to accomplish things, to do things in the world. Whether it's in the area of Torah, whether it's in learning Torah, whether it's in teaching Torah, whether it's supporting Torah, whether it's in Avodah, whether it's in Tefillah, whether it's in the person himself, if davening for other people, whether it's being involved in the shul and making sure the shul runs properly, so that other people can daven properly, whether it's in Gemilas Chasodim, that a person's mission is to help others, to accomplish for others. There's a whole broad range of different missions that a person could possibly have in this world. But what's beloved by Hashem is when a person devotes himself to that mission, he dedicates himself to that mission to the extent that he's willing to give up the pleasures of the world, he's willing to give up the comforts of the world, his desires to abandon the world of physical and material pleasures in order to fulfill that mission. What Hashem desires from a person is that a person takes his mission seriously, and he has true devotion and dedication to that mission to the extent that he's willing to leave that world behind, leave the Olam Hazeh behind, and go in, attach himself to that world of the Anani HaKavod, to fulfill the mission of Hashem, to attach himself to Hashem by fulfilling the mission of Hashem. That's what Hashem desires from a person. That's the way that a person brings nachas and pleasure to Hashem, by a person being that shliach mitzvah. Shliach mitzvah doesn't necessarily mean that a person has to be traveling, or travel all over the world. But a person who dedicates himself, devotes himself to his particular mission, whatever it might be, to the extent that he's willing to give up the pleasures and the comforts of the world to fulfill that mission, that's something the Medrash tells us is chavdu fnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's beloved to Hashem. Hashem loves that so much. And that is the way that a person finds favor in the eyes of Hashem. Let's continue. Source Yod, number 10. Pasuk Beis. Vayomer lemelech Yerichoy leimar. It was said to the king of Yerichoy, saying, Hine anoshim bo'u heino halayla. Behold, men have come here tonight, mi b'nei Yisrael, from amongst the Jewish people, lachper es ha'aretz, to spy out the land. So the king of Yericho, he gets a report that spies from the Jewish people came. The Jewish people wasn't the first time he heard about the Jewish people. This was something that was on the minds of the people who lived in Eretz Yisrael all this time. They knew one day the Jewish people would come and try to take over Eretz Yisrael. So he was told, given a very scary report, that some messengers from the Jewish people had managed to breach the security, whatever it is that they had there to protect themselves. They had managed to make their way into Yericho, and they were there to spy out the land. Aishlach Melech Yericho al Rochav Leimar, the king of Yericho, sent a message to Rochav saying, Hoitzi ha'anoshim ha'boim elayich. Send out the man who came to you, Asher Bo Leveisaich, who came to your house, Kilach Pores Kol Horetz Bo, because they came to spy out the entire land. So the king, he hears that there are messengers. Apparently he heard that they were in Rochav's house. So he sends a message to Rochav, send them out. Send them out to us, they're spies, they're criminals. Send them out, because they're a great threat to us. They're here to spy out the land. Pasuk Dalit says, "Vatikachu Isha Shnei Ha'anoshim Vatitz Pinoy." So the woman took the two men and she hid them. Matoimer, she said, Kain bowe laihu anoshim. She sends a message back to the king. Kain indeed bowe laihu anoshim. The men came to me. Vloyodati mi ayin heima, but I had no idea where they were from. Don't blame me. I had no idea where they were from. I didn't know they came from the Jewish people. And therefore, I didn't call the police. When they showed up, I had no idea where they were from. Don't blame me. Because I had no idea. I had no idea that there was anything wrong with them. That's these psukim give us the back and forth between the king of Yericho, his messengers, and Rachav. In this last pasuk here, in pasuk Dalid, pasuk says, "Vatikachu isho shneihu anoshim." The woman took the two men, vatitzpenoi. She hid them. The simple reading of the pasuk seems to say that at this point she took them and she hid them. And now, after the messengers from the king came and told her, send these men out, so then she went and hid them. That's a bit difficult, because if they weren't hidden, so then why weren't they caught right away? It would seem that she should hide them before the king's messengers showed up, not after the king's messengers showed up. That's a bit risky to wait till the king's messengers show up and then hide them. And indeed, Radak writes that even though it would seem that the words mean that she then hid them, Radak says that it means that she already hid them. As far as the word batitz penoy, the word batitz penoy should mean, and she hid him. Now we know that there were two miraglim, two spies here, not just one. So what does it mean, vatitz penoy? So the Targum actually says that it means that she hid them both. Rashi says that sometimes that's the way the Torah, that's the way the Nevi'im talk, that they use the singular, right? Vatitz penoy is singular, and really it means plural. Okay? Fine. However, more satisfying explanation, it seems to be vatitz penoy means she hid each one individually. She didn't necessarily hide them together. Vatitz penoy, she hid each one of them. Not necessarily hid them together. However, the Medrash, take a look in Source Yud Aleph, the Medrash tells us something else. Medrash said that Rachav was going to hide both Pinchas and Kalev. However, Pinchas said to her, Ani Kohen, I'm a Kohen. And Kohanim are like Malachim, Kohanim like angels. That's possible in Malachi. It says, Ki Sifsei Kohen Yishmeru Das, V'Seri Yimakshu Mipihu, Ki Malach Hashem Tzavaku Yisu. The Pasuk of Malachi talks about a Kohen, Sifsei Kohen, and says, Ki Malach Hashem Tzavaku Yisu. He's a Malach, he's an angel of Hashem. And an angel sometimes can be seen, like by Avraham, or sometimes he's not seen. It says, the Medrash says, the same applies to Nevi'im. Nevi'im, we find numerous places, the Nevi'im, prophets, are referred to as Malachim, compared to Malachim, angels. So both Kehanim and Malachim, I'm sorry, both Kehanim and Nevi'im are compared to angels. And angels could sometimes be seen, sometimes not be seen. So therefore, Pinchas said, don't worry, I'll take care of myself. I'm a Kohen, I'm a Navi, so I'll make myself invisible. No one will be able to see me, so you don't have to worry about hiding me. And therefore, Medrash says, how do we know that Rachav only hid Kalev? Shnemar, it says, the woman took the two men, and she hid him. I mean, she took both men, she was going to hide both Kalev and Pinchas. However, she only ended up hiding Kalev because Pinchas disappeared. Okay. Now, there are a number of other questions that have to be addressed on these psukim. The first question, right off the bat, is how in the world did the king of Yerichai find out that there were spies here? It says, it was told to the king of Yerichai that men have come from the Jewish people to spy out the land. It doesn't tell us where they got this information from. How they find out, how they know that these people came as spies. Now perhaps you'll say that he caught on right away. You see these people walking around and they're acting like they're deaf. So they caught on right away. This is strange. Two deaf people hanging out together all of a sudden. This is a little too strange. They caught on right away and they figured out the plan. Well, if that's the case, it's a bit strange that Yeshua didn't foresee this. Yeshua was leader of the Jewish people. He definitely was no fool. So why didn't he figure out that it's going to look quite suspicious when these two deaf people all of a sudden walk into town? So this is a bit of explanation, what exactly happened over here, what went wrong, what was the plan, how did they expect not to arouse suspicion, and why did they arouse suspicion? That's one question. Another question is, as Pasuk Gimel says, that the king of Yerichai sends a message to Rachav, he says, send out the men. Send out the men. Send out the men who came to your house. Now, we just saw Gemara in Zvachim before. Gemara in Zvachim says that Rochav's house was a very busy place. And the Pazi said that there was no Nogid. In Chokol Sarv, Nogid, Shleibah, Rochav HaZayin. It was a very busy place, Rochav's house. There was a lot of people there. Officers, important people, perhaps less important people. There was a lot of people around there. The king sends a messenger, send out the men who came to your house. There's 100 people here. Send out the men who came to my house. What was the message that the king was sending? What did he expect Rochav to understand? And Rochav answers as if she understands exactly what the king's talking about. How did the description of Ha'anoshim, how did that suffice to explain what the king wanted and for Rochav to understand who he was referring to? Furthermore, the pasuk says that the king said, send out the men ha'boyim elayich asher bo'u leveseich, that came to you, that they came to your house. It seems a bit repetitive. That they came to you, they came to your house. Say they came to your house, they came to you. Well, why both? One more question. Buzzy says, why should, what about these people? What's the problem with these people? Why should you send them out? Kilach pores kol ha'aretz bo'u. They came to spy out the entire land. Why the word kol? Entire land. Say, kilach pores ha'aretz bo'u. They came to spy out the land. If they only came to spy out Yerichai, so then we have no problem. If they only came to spy out a part of the land, then it's fine. Well, except we're willing to accept spies, as long as you're not going to spy on the whole land. Why do you say they came to spy the whole land? So the Or HaChaim is actually, if you open the Novi, chances are you won't find the commentary of the Or HaChaim, but there's a different sefer of the Or HaChaim called Rishon LeZion, which he writes on a bunch of different areas of Torah. One area of Torah he writes on is a little bit of Nevi'im and Ksuvim. So he writes on this section of Sefer Yehoshua. And he gives us a lot of background, fills in a lot of details to this story to give us a better explanation of what's happening here at these psukim, to explain a lot of the difficulties in the language of the psukim and difficulties in what's happening here in the story. So he says like this. He says, like I mentioned before, everyone knew that the Jewish people were going to come at some point and attack Eretz Yisrael, try to invade and conquer Eretz Yisrael. Everyone knew that. So the people were on high alert. The people in Eretz Yisrael, they were on high alert. They were they had the customs agents, they had the border patrol, they had people there keeping an eye on who comes in. They were very vigilant to find out who was coming in to make sure that people wouldn't come in from the Jewish people. So Yehoshua understood that. So Yehoshua planned the following. The way the Rechaim understands the idea of Cheresh is like this. He understood that the people are going to be very sensitive to anything that the new people who show up in the land, the people of the land are going to be very sensitive to everything they do to see if perhaps these are people from the Jewish people who are coming to spy out the land or coming to attack. So therefore, he told them, what you're going to do is you're going to act not only deaf, but mute too. If you start talking, even though you could speak the language, but if you have the wrong accent, then already you're going to arouse suspicion. Go there, no talking. No talking. Right? And also, you have to act deaf too, because this way you can find out the secrets, like we mentioned before. So you're going to go in, you're going to act deaf and mute. No talking, no listening, nothing. This way, no, they won't be able to catch you from your accent, from the way in which you talk. And also, you'll act deaf, so you'll be able to, they won't have any problems with saying their secrets around you, because they'll be convinced that you can't hear. That was Yeshua's plan. Now, the Baraglim, when they came there, so they had their own additional idea. They said, if we want them to not suspect us of being from the Jewish people, being spies to the Jewish people, the best thing we can do is we can go to Rochav, to the Zoyna. If we go to Rochav, to the Zoyna, so people have no way, the people know that the Jewish people are Prushim and Harayos. Jewish people, they avoid, they stay away from any sort of adultery, from any sort of improper conduct in that area. And therefore, if we go to the house of Rochav, certainly they weren't going to commit any aveiros, do anything wrong. But if we go there, then no, there's no way the people will suspect us of being Jews if we go there. They said, in addition, we also have to avoid, if they want to test us out, right, they know about Jews. So if they're not sure, if they have any doubts about us, so then they'll bring in a pig from the yard, they'll chop it up and serve it to us and say, why don't you enjoy some dinner? So to avoid, they wanted to go to the fullest extreme. People should have no doubts at all about that they might be Jews. So they came in, they went straight to the house of Rochav, straight to the house of the Zoyna. to this way, people wouldn't suspect him of being Jewish. Now, what went wrong? Assuming they could be a pretty good plan. So what went wrong here? See, he says the following. He says, when they came in, people see these deaf mutes coming in. Okay, it seems a bit suspicious, but, you know, so I guess they're on alert a little bit. Maybe they have some people trailing them. So, but they're not, people weren't sure. We weren't sure. On one hand, you know, it seems a bit suspicious, all of a sudden these two deaf mutes show up. But on the other hand, okay, you know, well, why should we suspect them of being Jews? Then they see them go to Rachav's house, to the house of the Zayin. So their immediate reaction is, okay, these are not Jews. But then, after a moment's contemplation, they say to themselves, wait one second, there's something very suspicious about this. It's not the normal way for two people to go together to the house of the Zayin. A person is going to go to the Zayin, he goes alone. People don't go in groups to the Zayin. Each person goes on his own. It's not something people do together. It's not something that people do in groups. That's something people do on their own. If two people are going together to the house of the Zayin, that's extremely suspicious. There's something wrong with this. These people must not really be going there to actually make use of her services. Rather, they must have other intentions over here. They say, okay, that's enough for us to suspect and to perhaps assume that these people are trying to hide something. These must be Jews who are coming to spy out the land. That's the conclusion that the people reached. And that's how the king of Yericho got this message. It was told to Yericho. Perhaps it was the citizens on the street who saw this transpiring, or maybe they had some KGB agents following them around, and they see them going in together to the Zayinah, so their suspicions were aroused, and they said, they reached the conclusion, these must be spies from the Jewish people, and so they reported back to the king. So says the Arachayim, now according to this, with this background, we can understand the language of the Pasuk. Pasuk says that the Melech, the king of Yericho, sends a message to Rachav. What's the message? It says, "Hoitzi ho anoshim, send the men." Now, which men? What are you talking about? Haboim elayich. That they're coming together. Haboim, they're coming as a group. They're coming plural. They came as a group to you. And the king of Yericho says that two people coming to you, it's not a normal occurrence. It's not an everyday thing that people come to you in groups. People usually come alone. So I want the people, the men, Hanoshim, Asher, Ba'u, Eliyah, they came to you together. They came to you as a group. Those people, you can pick them out very clearly, very easily. The people who came as a group, those are the ones who I want. That's what aroused my suspicion, the fact that they were Ba'im Eliyah, they came together to you. Now, perhaps they'll say, well, how do I know that they came for any purpose that they're coming in a group would be suspicious? And maybe they came for some other reason. So he says, no. He says, Asher bo levesek. He says, presumably, Rachav had either a house where she lived, and she had another area in which she entertained her customers. Or perhaps she had, maybe according to the Targum, she had a hotel, and separately she had another business on the side of being a Zayna. Whatever it was, the point is the king says to her, the reason why they're coming in a group is suspicious is Asher bo levesek. They came to your house of your base Zinus, the place where you carry out snus, they came to that house. So the king says, I have very clear indications, I have very strong evidence that what's going on here is suspicion. I want those men who came together for your services, which makes no sense, because people don't come together for that, they come alone. And how do I know they came for your services? Ashabol, the basic. They came to the house, to the area that's designated for that. That's what the king says, that's how he described who he wanted and why he wanted them, what his basis was. In fact, they came in a group. They came to her in a group. They came specifically to the area where she practiced her znus. So therefore, that's how the king, that's how they knew, that's what aroused their suspicion, and that's how he indicated to Rachav exactly who it was that he wanted and why he wanted them. Now, says the Arachayim, the king was a bit worried here. He was afraid that maybe Rachav would actually try to protect them. Once they came and they wanted her protection, perhaps she would protect them. So he felt that he couldn't really compel her, he couldn't force her to give them over. Why not? As we saw in the Gemara in Zvachim before, the Gemara in Zvachim tells us that the Rachav had a very good relationship. She was well connected to all the Sarim and the Negidim, she was with all the officers, with all the high government officials, she was well connected with them. So she was well connected with all of them. So the king of Jericho, on his own, is not going to be able to force Rahab to do anything, because if he starts up with her, so she'll have all her friends, the kings and the officers, she'll have them protect her, and she'll have them take care of the king of Jericho. So the king needed to find a way to convince Rahab that she should be willing to give over these spies willingly. So the king says to her like this. He says, you think that if you don't give over these spies, all your buddies, the Sarv, and all the Sorim, the Negidim, the officers, you think they're going to protect you, take care of you? He says, no, that's not the case. Because for them, these spies are just as much a danger to them as they are to me. Don't think that they came here only to spy at Jericho and everyone else is safe, everyone else will protect you. Because no. Because Lachboris kol ha'aretz bo. They came to spy out the entire land. So don't think that you could try to protect these people and that you yourself will have the protection of all your the officers, all these people who you're connected with. They're not going to protect you. Because these people are just as much of a threat to them as they are to me, because they came to spy out the whole land. So don't think that you can protect these spies and still get away with it. Furthermore, says the Arachayim, he says to her, don't think that you're fine because they'll come attack Jericho and you'll go find someone else to live in Eretz Yisrael. They don't think you can get away with it. Don't think that these people are not a threat to you yourself, because you could escape if they come to attack, because Lachbert's color, it's bow. They came to spy out the entire land. There's no safe haven. Don't think you can get away from it. These people are a threat to you. They're a threat to me. They're a threat to all the officers, all the kings of the land. Therefore, you better give them up, give them over, because they're a threat to you. You won't be protected from them. And if you don't give them over, everyone will be against you, because these people are a threat to everybody. Now, we pointed out before that it seems like Rahab only hid them after the king's messengers showed up. So why is that? So he says the following. He says the king sent messengers to Rahab's house. Now Rahab was an important person. Like I mentioned before, she was well connected with all the important officials. So people didn't just barge into her house. If you wanted to come into your house, even if you're the king's messenger, you show up at the door. The maid comes and answers the door, finds out what you want, and only once you have permission, you can be let into the house. So, it's like this. First of all, the king wasn't very concerned that Rahab would actually try to hide these spies. The king had no reason to believe that Rahab would actually want to protect them. In other words, he might have suspected, but he had no strong, compelling reason to think she would protect them. They're a threat to her just as much as they're a threat to him. So he had no reason to believe that Rahab would try to protect them. So therefore, he had no reason to send in the SWAT team to barge in and go find them. There was no reason to think that Rahab would hide them. Most probably, she'll just give them over. Rahab herself, perhaps, had no clue that these people were spies at this point. Perhaps the Kalev and Pinchas, they didn't tell her right away that they were spies. So therefore, the king sent the messengers. Messengers knock on the door. And the messengers aren't let into the house. They speak to the shifcha, to the maidservant, to the maid at the door. And the maid goes and relays the message to Rahab. He says, that's what the pasuk says. Vayishlach melech Michael Rahab lemor. He sent the message to Rahab saying, he sent the message to the maid, lemor, to tell over to Rahab. The message didn't go directly from the messengers of the king to Rahab, rather went to the middleman of the maid. So Rahab now understood that these people who were in her house were spies. And Rahab wanted to protect them. And therefore, Rahab went ahead, and at this point, she hid them. Quickly, right away, she hid them. So the king's messengers didn't barge into the house right away, because they had no reason to think she would hide them. And they didn't necessarily have the ability to barge in. Rahab's home was not a place, Rahab's place, whatever it was, wasn't a place where you barge into. So Rahab now had the opportunity to hide them. So the Arachayim assumes that she only hid one of them. But this Panoi, he takes the word literally, she hid one of them. And she felt safe, at least for the time being, hiding one of them. If the king's messengers were now to decide that they want to barge in, they think that she's playing games, she's trying to protect them. So then the king's messengers, if they were to barge in, so she still felt it was good enough to hide one of them. Why? If she hides one of them, there's only one person around, so she'll say, listen, the only reason you came here is because you told me two people came together. Well, there's no two people together here, so, you know, maybe the people who came left already, go find them elsewhere, but they're not here because here you are, there's only one person here, there's no second person. So she felt confident hiding only one of them, and not the other one in her haste to hide them. So therefore, she at this point, when she first found out that they were spies, and she still had the opportunity because the king's messengers didn't come into the house, they were waiting by the door, so she hid one of them. And with that, she felt confident that were they to come in, she could defend them and defend herself by saying that they don't have the right people here, she'd have to go find them elsewhere. And then, once the king's messengers left, then, as the pasuk says, then at that point, she hid them both in case they were to come back. They go around, they can't find these people, they were to come back and to question her further and interrogate her, and she'll have them both hidden, and she won't have any problems at all. That's how the Rechaim goes through these psukim and explains how to work out all the details, which I think we did. All right, I think we'll stop here.